I can get your attention, we'll go ahead and get kicked off at the meeting. Appreciate JC being here and all the division folks. Thank you so much. We'll start off with introductions as we always do. So let's start with you down there, Tim.
Public at large.
Randy Durth, the sportsman.
Boyd Blackwell, Division of Wildlife.
Andrea Merrill, non-consumptive member, the last meeting. And then my turn's over with. So, Jay, when does your term end?
I don't have one.
My vote ends. You've been here ever since I've been on this board.
And Dan Abeda with the Ashley.
Before we get going to the agenda a little bit, I'd like to apologize to the RAC members, although I didn't do anything wrong. I think all the RAC members received an email that said it was from me asking for some email gift cards emailed to them. Yeah, somebody looked like they hacked the website and sent all the everybody tickets or wanting them to buy tickets in my name, but that was not me. So
nice job the way he handled that, though.
Yeah, he did. When Brett got it, he asked him to give him a call real quick, and they wrote back and said that they were out of service. They couldn't have any service right then, but go ahead and get those tickets coming, those gift cards coming. So anyway, let's talk about our agenda first off. Do we have any modification of the agenda, or can we have a motion to approve it?
I'll make a motion that we approve the agenda as written.
I'll second that motion.
Motion by Andrea Merrill, second by Brett Prevedel. All in favor? And it is unanimous. How about our minutes? Has everybody had a chance to review the minutes of our last meeting? Is there any modifications or changes need made to those minutes?
I just had one small one. I can find you the page. They were right here, weren't they, in this packet? No, they weren't. They were on the Dropbox. It was just I can get with her later. It was just instead of winter, it was just said winter.
It was
the idea of
okay.
We were going to get a hard winter and it was going to kill the deer.
Just misspelled then.
And well, it was. I probably said the way it's written, but that's not what I meant. But. So I will point that out to them afterward. But so one minor modification, or I can find it right now.
In the vote here.
Sorry, I should have been ready.
It was a long meeting. There were a lot of notes.
Let's just proceed. We'll just go ahead.
Can we vote with them?
Do you know what the word was you're looking for?
It was talking about the increase in deer tags on the South Slope general season deer.
What was
and
that?
I'd made the motion to reduce it from 150 to 50. So it was in that same discussion.
You know what the word was itself?
Winter.
I believe it says in there that Randall had mentioned that sooner or later we're going to get a tough winter, and it's going to take down our herd.
So is the word winter that was incorrect?
And the word in there is winner.
Winner, W-I-N-N-E-R?
Yes.
Can you look up that?
You could just do a, like, control.
Winner, winner, winner.
Here it is. It's on page, and there's no pages on this stuff. So, how do you find that page? But there's the text right there.
It doesn't have a page number.
We were talking about shooting deer before we got a hard winter.
So what Brett is written here, it says, my perception of that is we are a year late because we had all those them good years, and when we classified last year postseason, there were lots of bucks, or really nice bucks in that unit, and we talked about it that one of these days we're going to get some winners, W-I-N-N-E-R-S, and you said it last year. And it should have, and that word should have said winters, correct?
Yeah, it was talking about losing deer in the winter.
So can we,
some winters instead of winters?
Yeah. It should be winters instead of the word winters.
I guess I'd prefer now to say winter kill, some winter kill.
So with that one modification change, that correction, can we call for a vote? Or call for a motion?
Yeah.
Motion to accept.
I'll second the motion.
Tim Ignacio made a motion to accept it with that one correction, seconded by Rebecca Jones. All in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you. Wildlife Board meeting update. A couple things. Director Falks, I talked a little bit about the harsh winter that we had and how it affected the state's deer herds. The northern region primarily lost to older does, about the 7.5 plus year old does. Not as quite as bad on the fawn, he said. And then he reported that Mike Styler is retiring and that Brian Steed will be replacing Mike. And then they talked about the aquatics division. That's and how effective they are, and how they've been able to keep fully keep up with all the fish stocking needs, and double stocking in some areas. So that's really awesome. Talked about the retirement of Supervisor Blackwell here, and from the Northeast region, and now he'll be leaving us at the end of this month. And then he talked a little bit about the legislation, how they've approved an additional $400,000 to help with landowner depredation. And then on some of the votes, the motions that took place, on the there was a motion made to approve the rule amendments for the big game draw applications as presented, with the inclusion of shotguns as a primitive weapon, and that passed unanimous. And then on the bucks, bulls, and once in a lifetime, there was a motion that we accept the division's recommendation for Pine Valley with an increase of 300 tags for the 2019 general season permit numbers, and that passed unanimous. There was a motion to keep the 2020-2040 allocation, same number of weapons, same number of hunters, but reallocate the number of general season tags to the early rifle hunt to address the overcrowding. And that failed for lack of a second. There was a motion to keep the Zion sheep rifle tag numbers the same in 2018, which was 11 tags, with the addition of 3 archery tags. And that passed, I think, unanimous. And then there was a motion that they decrease the deer tags on the Manti unit by 500. And that passed unanimous. There was a motion to decrease the South Cache elk unit from 53 to 40 tags, and that passed 4-2. There was a motion to that we accept the Northeast region's RAC's recommendation to increase to 50 instead of 150, and then that motion was actually withdrawn. And then they had another motion to replace that one, that they adjust the increase on the South Slope Yellowstone unit season tags from 150, reduce it down to 100. So basically, they hit in the middle. We proposed 50, and they recommended 100 there. And then there's another motion that we moved to add the action log, that the division research the possibility of moving the application deadline to after establishing permit numbers. There was a motion that we accept the remainder of the 2019 permit recommendations as presented by the division, and it passed unanimous. On the antlerless permit recommendations, There was a motion that we move to create a new hunt on the North Beaver unit using existing boundaries and reallocate the statewide 150 permits to the unit with season dates of August 1st to the 11th, and that passed 4-2. There was a motion that moved that we compromise on the increased permit number of 1,000 on the Chalk Creek East Canyon antlerless deer by cutting the numbers in half proportionally for each hunt, 250 for private land only and 50 for private land archery only, 100 public draw archery only and 100 public draw ALW, and that passed unanimous. And then there was a motion to approve the remainder of the recommendations for antlerless permit numbers and as it was presented by the division, and it passed unanimous. As far as the CWMU rule amendments, there was a motion that they approve it as presented by division, and it passed unanimous. On the CWMU antlerless permit recommendations, there was a motion to accept that as presented by division, and it passed unanimous. On the big game depredation rule amendments, there was a motion to approve that as presented by the division, and it passed unanimous. And then on the conservation and sportsman permit rule amendments, there was a motion that we maintain the one-year program and permit conservation groups that their employees and agents the authority to purchase the auction tag at a live auction public. It's a public auction, well-advertised auctions at whatever bid price, and accept the remainder of the rule amendments. And that passed unanimous. Remember, we had a lot of discussion in our RAC with that one because there was one group in our group that I think it was the Houndsman wanted that. So actually, that turned out good. I think that was a pretty good outcome on that one. Any questions? All right, turn the time over to for Boyd for our regional supervisor update.
Okay, in the region, the wildlife section has been busy. Well, they should be wrapping up their spring deer classifications. I imagine access, though, has been a real issue this year. Mid-elevations have just been horrible to get into. I know that sage-grouse counts appear to be down. However, with the access issues, I'm sure that that has something to play in that. The aquatics folks have been busy collecting fish and sampling, and they've also been really busy stocking waters in the region. I know they've had two of the big trucks going up and down from the gorge this week, and they've been working hard to stock waters. They've got their we've got this fishing with a fox thing that's just started up, and they have been tagging fish for that. They've put fish up in moose ponds, lower still water at the pier. Is it the pier pond? And one other pond. What was the other pond? Was it Red Fleet? Okay, all right, and into Red Fleet. So they're really busy doing their thing. And the rumors are true. I am retiring. I'll be gone the end of the week, and, well, the end of next week, maybe earlier, who knows. Want to introduce you to the new regional supervisor, Miles Hanberg. He was selected out of a competitive group. I feel real good about all four that went in. They were all from our region. They're all regional managers that served with me, and I want them to know that I'm really proud of them and the efforts that they put in. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Boyd. Okay, we'll get kicked off with our first action item. Turn the time over to Dax for our wild turkey transplant list.
All right. All right. Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the RAC. So you might know me. I typically work here in the region. I've been on a temporary assignment working in the Salt Lake office's Upland Game Program Coordinator. So tonight I'll be presenting our wild turkey transplant site list for 2019 through 2024. Just a brief overview of what I'll cover tonight. Talk a little bit about wild turkeys in Utah and how they're doing. Some of the tools we use for managing wild turkey populations, and specifically go into a little more detail into the trapping and transplanting and what we've been doing there. And then this recommendation represents a transition from a written list of transplant sites to map-based locations. We feel like as GIS has become more and more prevalent, it helps us be a little bit more transparent about where specifically we're looking to move birds to. In the past, we just had a list of sites, and you know, we had listed in the booklets the Willow Creek drainage. And from the top of, you know, head of East and West Willow to the bottom and confluence of the Green Rivers, you know, 40 miles long and in some places 20, 30 miles wide. So this transition to these map-based sites, I think, is more specific and more transparent to where we're looking to actually release turkeys that we transplant. And then we'll go through those proposed release sites. And so let's jump into it. The wild turkey population in Utah, right now, current estimate between 25 and 35,000 birds. And just to put that in context, I think wild turkeys are a really great conservation success story. If you look at wild turkeys prior to European settlement, pretty wide distribution, lots of wild turkeys in North America. After European settlement, you know, with things like firearms and just population expansion, habitat loss, it was estimated that wild turkey numbers in all of North America at one time were perhaps as few as 30,000 birds. So now we likely have more than that just in the state of Utah, and in North America, wild turkey populations now are between 6 and 7 million birds. So it's pretty amazing what conservationists can do and sportsmen and interested people can do when they put their heads together and try to do good things for a species. So our turkeys in Utah are doing well. In fact, in some places, perhaps too well. I wanted to go through some of the goals in our statewide wild turkey management plan that I think are applicable and help provide some context for this recommendation. One of our goals is to maintain and improve wild turkey populations to habitat or social carrying capacity. And that's a lot of times when we're doing this trap and transplant is because we have perhaps exceeded that social carrying capacity or the level of tolerance that folks might have for turkeys in a specific area. Minimize sheep and turkey conflicts is another one of the goals in the management plan. To improve turkey hunting opportunities, increase public appreciation of wild turkeys, and to enhance interagency cooperation. Some of the tools for managing wild turkeys, some people, the first thing that comes to their mind is to think about the spring hunts. And actually, the spring hunt is more of a recreational opportunity. In the spring hunt, we're targeting just bearded birds, so primarily males, that really aren't having a big impact on what happens in the turkey population, don't have a lot to do with overall numbers. The fall hunts that we have throughout different parts of the state are really geared more towards population management. You know, as I mentioned, kind of that context of wild turkey populations and how they had really declined is because these birds are definitely very sensitive to over-harvest, unregulated harvest. And the positive side to that is that if we do have areas where we have conflicts through strategic fall hunting, we can really try to help manage the population in those specific areas. With our fall hunting, we do allow harvest of any turkey in the fall versus bearded birds only in the spring. So that makes the harvest more likely to be additive mortality, which would reduce the population. These hunts, like I mentioned, are targeted to specific areas. It's very strategic, the hunt boundaries for these fall hunts, because turkeys are sensitive to harvest that time of year. Primarily private lands. If you look in the regions that do have fall hunts, those hunts are centered around private lands where there are areas with conflict. The fall hunts usually have longer seasons, and there's more weapon flexibility in the fall hunts as well. So while hunting is usually our preferred management tool to help us manage wildlife populations, there are some places where it's not a good fit. If you're looking at places where we have turkey conflicts, in town or on a golf course. There's safety considerations, legal considerations. Hunting usually often isn't a good fit in those type of situations. If you look all across kind of the east bench of that Wasatch Range and up into Cache Valley, we have kind of this suburban oak brush interface, I'm calling it. And, you know, oak brush is a great forage, great food source for turkeys, and happens in a lot of those areas to be adjacent to really big, nice homes with expensive landscaping and folks that aren't really excited about a lot of turkey droppings in their yard. You know, turkeys are big birds. They're the largest ground nesting bird in Utah, and if you have a big flock of turkeys that decide to roost on your deck, they can make quite a mess. So, so in those cases, trap and transplant's a good tool and the one that we use. Like I said, we're focusing these trapping efforts on problem areas. We're not going out to your favorite canyon on public land and trapping birds and moving them. We have plenty of places where we have conflicts to trap and move birds from. And then these transplanted birds can help us to bolster existing turkey populations or establish new populations. Here's a picture of probably the most common trap that we use for trapping turkeys. Winter is the best time to do it. Food is more scarce. The birds are more likely to key in on bait. So we'll set this trap. It's basically wire panels that are wired together, and then has effectively a one-way door. So the birds come in to eat the bait, the corn, and can't get back out. And then Division of Wildlife technicians check these traps regularly and use what is a kind of a miniature shepherd's crook there. That on the end of that pole, there's a little wire loop, and they'll grab them around the leg with that and pull them in and load them in a box, and then we can move them to another area where we think we'll have a less likelihood of them getting in trouble and causing conflict. This graph shows across the bottom there, those are winters. So if you see, you know, the year 10-11 would be the winter of 2010-2011. So those are the last 10 winters, and that's the number of birds that we trapped and transplanted. So over the last 10 years, we've trapped and transplanted almost 10,000 turkeys in the state. There's definitely some up and down there the last few years. Some of that has to do with winter severity. A year when you have deeper snow, the turkeys are more concentrated and trapping is more successful. And also some of it may have to do with kind of the residual effects from the prior year's trapping in some of these areas where we have a lot of birds and they have really good success trapping. It actually will suppress the population temporarily, but within a year they seem to bounce back. The Division of Wildlife, I don't know that this graph is what we would define as success. We would rather manage more of these turkey overpopulation issues with hunting and do less trapping, but we recognize there will always be places where we need to trap and move turkeys, and that's why we're proposing these release sites that we're discussing this evening. So these release sites, this is something that's identified in state code, the Division of Wildlife. So that's why we do this. One of the provisions in that code says that these sites have to have an expiration date. They can't be perpetual. So every 5 years, we take this list through, and it includes all sites, including sites that are augmentations where we've placed turkeys in the past. We feel that we need to do this in order to comply with the statute. The sites are developed with input from regional DWR staff, and if approved, they remain valid for 5 years. This year, again, we propose a transition from a written list of sites to mapped sites. And they would be valid from June of 2019 through June of 2024. So with that, I've got the maps. These were in the RAC packet. They're also on our website. I guess also just for context, the northern region and central region, probably 80%+ of our turkeys that are trapped and moved in the state come from those two regions. I think largely because of the kind of that suburban oak brush interface. If you look on this map, the yellow color is currently occupied wild turkey habitat. The blue color would be augmentations or supplemental releases, areas where we would be releasing turkeys where there are already turkeys. And the bright pink color, I called it fuchsia in a couple of the meetings, and people made fun of me. So I'm gonna stick with bright pink. It would be new sites, and oftentimes these new sites are areas where there's just not good connectivity to currently occupied wild turkey habitats. So, northern region. We'll just scroll through the regions here, and then we have regional staff here if we have specific questions about any of the areas in northeastern region. So central, and these maps show some overlap. Some, they're not, they show multiple regions in the maps, but just generally here's central region. And pink would be new sites, blue are existing sites, and the yellow is currently occupied. So southern region, southeastern, and the big one, northeastern. We've taken a lot of birds to the northeastern region over the last few years, and just because we felt like we had a lot of a pretty decent turkey habitat that had room for more birds and low likelihood for additional conflict or
problems. What are them big pink areas out there in South Duchesne? What is that area? Is that Sowers or?
Yes. Yeah.
Sowers Canyon.
Not the right Fork of Indian.
No, and that's it?
That's Indian Canyon and Sowers.
I'll leave it on this one, but yeah, that's it for the presentation.
Sowers, okay. So the main canyon.
Thank you, Dex. Questions by the rack. I'm not going to go through the card thing. JC knows the card rules, so I'm not going to go through that. So, but we'll still follow that rule if there's any comments afterwards. But yeah,
Mr.
Dan.
Chair, yeah, I've got a question. So Dax, can you kind of put that? Oh yeah, sorry. Dax, can you kind of put the? You showed a slide where the population estimate is somewhere in the state is somewhere between 25 and 35,000 birds. Yeah. To kind of put that into perspective, I know there's been a lot of efforts in the last decade. I'm not going to quote you on a number, but could you kind of put that into perspective in terms of, like, say, 10 years ago, what that population estimate would have been, just roughly ballpark me?
So it's kind of interesting, the history of wild turkeys in Utah. During European settlement, they didn't document any wild turkeys in Utah, but we have fossil evidence and archaeological evidence to support that there were turkeys in Utah. They tried some restoration efforts in the 40s. And 30s and 40s, and those were birds, they were easterns, and they were pen-reared, and they were not successful. So they tried again in the 70s, and they brought some Miriams from Texas, and they did establish in some parts of southern Utah. Mm-hmm. And then I think that was 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, they brought in some Rio Grande turkeys, and they started to do really well. I don't have the numbers, but... Mm-hmm. But those birds in the 80s started to really do well, and I think we kind of hit critical mass probably about 10, 15 years ago, where turkey numbers have really increased, and we were able to go to over-the-counter hunting opportunity in the spring, and turkey restoration and efforts in Utah have been really successful. I don't have numbers off the top of my head.
Would it be fair to say maybe the population has doubled in the last decade?
Probably so.
Yeah. Okay.
I've decided that they're just about everywhere until you have a tag, and then you can't find them. Other questions by the rack? Okay, any questions in the public? JC?
JC Brewer. I'm a little short and this thing's stiff. As everybody in this room knows, I spend lots of time in the southeast corner of Uinta County. Cameras and recreation in general. For a couple of years, when you guys were first introducing turkeys out there, there was lots of turkeys. I see turkeys everywhere. Got lots of turkeys on the cameras. The last year, 18 months, not so much. Did we have a die-off in the southern Uinta County? Have we lost some turkeys out there? Because I'm not seeing anywhere near what I did a couple of years ago.
I don't know if you want to talk to this, Clint. I'll let Clint talk to it. I'm Salt Lake. I'm a Salt Lake guy now.
Clint Sampson, a wildlife biologist. As to JC's question, it is kind of puzzling. The turkeys were doing phenomenal. They were doing really well. I had several reports from hunters this last spring. They found it more lot more difficult than they have in the past. And we have had, you know, a fairly severe winter out there, but in general, I'm not finding, you know, big piles of birds, you know, that are, or big piles of feathers, or nothing really indicating that, yeah, you know, all these birds got snowed in up high and they all died. Or I think some of the ones that we transplanted didn't stay exactly where we wanted them to, and they moved further north along the White River, and that's where I found people did have success. So what I've found before, historically, we've had them extremely far south in our region, and the winters kind of either push them out or kill them, but they will come back. One example is in the Robles area. They were pretty prominent when I first showed up about 12 years ago in there, and then we had a really severe winter, snowed extremely high levels and pushed the birds out. But now, as I ride down there, I'll kick up several different flocks of turkeys. So I think it's just, you know, that boom bust of upland game.
Before you run away, I think the predators eat just about everything. A couple years ago, I got off work, come home, and I found a few feathers in my dog run and a turkey foot, where one of them had landed in my dog run. I had two bird dogs. I guess so. There wasn't a whole lot left when those bird dogs got done, put it that way. And I'm sure the bird couldn't get out of the ground once he landed in there. But do we have a coyote problem and a lion problem that do you think has decimated some of these things? If we're, you know, is there any? I mean, because I don't think you're going to find much if that's the case.
Yeah, I've found dead turkeys before with feathers and stuff like that, and there really isn't that much. You know, there's really not that much to them anyway. But there definitely could be issues with predators out there. Especially, I think, in the deep snows might give them the advantage.
Okay.
Can I add something? They're down everywhere. Farm Creek, or I have some places, they're way, way down this year. And I think it's kind of consistent through all the upland game. Last fall, there didn't seem to be much production of quail, pheasants, or turkeys. And so I think you had low production going into the winter, and then you had probably an abnormally high loss during the winter, because they're probably 10 to 20% of what it was a year ago in Farm Creek, unless they just didn't come back, which would surprise me.
Yeah, I
would think they would come back. So everything's just, I think the upland game really took a beating with the dry summer.
Yeah, we definitely see it's kind of a 1-2 punch if you have the drought and then couple it with a hard winter. And, you know, the good thing about upland game is they're a relatively short-lived species. They have pretty high mortality, but they do have potential to really reproduce quickly. You know, if they pull off a clutch with, you know, 12 chicks, they can bounce back quickly. But, you know, they definitely, you know, the weather can play a factor. Predators can play a factor. If you have, you know, in the book list, if you have a year where you don't have pinion nut production, can make a big difference. One of the things I just thought I'd mention, you might think it's interesting. We've been putting bands on the male birds that are translocated, and then we've been getting some band reports. It's not a huge sample size, but we are seeing some birds that are surviving and lasting for a while, and the movements have been kind of interesting. We had some birds that traveled, you know, almost 15 miles along the Duchesne River corridor from where they were released to where they were harvested by a hunter the next year. And one of the things we're doing right now, we just got funding approved for a project to put some GPS transmitters on some of the turkeys that we trap and translocate. Now, we've got some birds with GPS transmitters on them now down in southern Utah near Escalante, and some in Mendon in northern Utah. And those have just been birds that we trapped, put transmitters on, and then released. So, and now we're going to trap and put transmitters on and then translocate some turkeys to look at habitat use and dispersal and survival, and maybe compare that to some of the birds, you know, a bird that isn't moved versus a bird that is moved, and I'm hoping maybe we can answer some of these questions and maybe identify some more of the limiting factors. I think the bottom line, when you have rough winters or extreme drought conditions, there's not a whole lot you can do generally, but I'm hoping we can maybe identify some of those limiting factors and learn some stuff through this study that will start next winter with birds that are translocated.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I do have a comment. From the Forest Service perspective, we would just request that as those augmentations and introductions on the forest occur, just to kind of give us a heads up when they're happening. So we appreciate that.
Any other discussion on this particular action item? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah.
Dan?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we accept this the turkey transplant, I guess you call it, the action item here to, as presented. So.
We have a second?
I'll make a second.
Tim made the second. Dan made the motion. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Dex.
Thanks. It's great to be back here in Northeastern region. Good to see you guys.
All right. Next thing we've got to the collection, importation, and possession rule amendments from Drew Dittmer.
Skip ahead. That's all right. Hello. My name is Drew Dittmer. I'm a relatively new employee with the division. I work in the Salt Lake office. I'm a native species coordinator with the native species section, which is nested in the aquatics division, part of the division. And I've only been around since roughly October, so about 6 months on the job. And since day one, this is pretty much what I was tasked to work on, was the revision of this rule for regarding our collection, importation, and possession of reptiles and amphibians. Worked on this rule with a user group of reptile and amphibian enthusiasts, the Attorney General's office, and then myself. I think a good place to start is to discuss who the user group members are. So they come from a variety of backgrounds. They're researchers, public land managers, parents, school teachers, university professors, hobbyists, and amateur naturalists and citizen scientists. And what all of these individuals have in common is that an activity known as herping is very strongly tied to their identity. So herping is like birding in that you go out on the landscape looking for reptiles and amphibians, and you record when and where and what you see. However, unlike birding, the activity of herpetoculture is strongly tied to the activity of herping. Now, not everybody who goes herping also engages in herpetoculture, but many do. So herpetoculture is, in addition to going out and looking for these things, you might occasionally capture them and bring them into your home to continue observations of these organisms. So the user group formed because currently, under our current regulation structure, they're required to obtain a certificate of registration, or a COR, to participate in these activities. So to collect, possess, import, or breed reptiles that are native to the state of Utah, they have to get a COR for those things that are classed as controlled. They have to obtain a variance, which is an exception from the Wildlife Board for any species that's categorized them, that these regulations are complicated and overly restrictive, and it can take a long time for them to get their COR to engage in these activities. And so it interferes with the general public's ability to enjoy these wildlife species. In addition, the user group pointed out that we have a long list of prohibited species in our current rule. And so there's thousands of reptile species in the world. We can't possibly list them all as prohibited, effectively anyway. So we worked with them to develop more categorical ways to list prohibited species. So moving forward with this new regulation, the recommendations that we have several benefits to the Division of Wildlife Resources. First and foremost, we gain a new constituency group. These are people who, in their free time, go look for reptiles and amphibians that are native to the state of Utah. They have knowledge that is very important for the management of these species that they gather in their own free time. And so we're working together to develop this regulation that they then pipe that information into us, into the native species section. And so that's going to include some harvest reporting, and then we'll structure bag limits and a citizen science element around that harvest reporting. In addition, we're going to move to a permit process that will, an education course will be the barrier to entry to acquire your permit to engage in this activity instead of the certificates of registration. And this is going to make for simpler regulations overall. So the proposed rule that we're presenting today is 17 pages. Our old rule is 31 pages. So we're getting just a more simplified regulation. And finally, the user group helped us really define when a species is wild and when it is not wild. So anything that's born in captivity is not wild. It's not a take from the wild. So it's not a detriment to harvest from wild populations. And we worked with the user group to develop this definition. CORs aren't going away. We're still going to require certificates of registration for native venomous species, so people that want to acquire rattlesnakes for personal use are still going to need to apply for a certificate of registration. That'll come to the Salt Lake office across my desk, and we'll develop criteria for approval or disapproval of those applications. Commercial businesses are going to need a COR. Some scientific collecting and some educational use categories are going to require a COR as well. Non-native venomous species will require a variance from the Wildlife Board for possession. So they're going to be effectively prohibited unless the Wildlife Board approves their possession. And again, I really want to strongly emphasize, no permit's going to be required to capture, photograph, and release reptiles or amphibians. So if you're out on the landscape and you're going for a hike with your son or daughter or yourself and you catch a lizard and you catch a frog, you want to take a photograph of it and let it go, cool, do that. Absolutely, no permit required. So the rules that we're proposing and putting forward today, this is how we stack up with other states. So there's two broad categories to consider here. There's rules governing the commercial collection of reptiles and amphibians and personal collection of reptiles and amphibians. So as far as commercial collection goes, it hasn't been allowed in Utah and will continue to not be allowed in Utah to capture wild reptiles and amphibians and then immediately sell those. And we'll be consistent with Nevada, Arizona, and Colorado along with those rules. New Mexico, Wyoming, and Idaho vary on to what degree they allow commercial harvest. And as far as I know, those three states are phasing this out anyway. It just take a few years. Personal collection, we actually, with this proposed rule, are still going to be on the conservative end of the spectrum. So we're going to have a permit. We're not going to have seasons yet, but we'll, the structure of what we're proposing allows us to establish seasons on a need basis. We're establishing limits for all native species, and we're establishing a reporting requirement that I'll break down in a few slides. So just to break down what the permit is, the barrier to entry for requiring your permit is going to be the education course. The education course is going to cover basic biology of reptiles and amphibians with an emphasis on Utah's native reptile and amphibian diversity. It's roughly 15 amphibians and 61 reptiles known in the state. We're going to cover safety in quite a bit of depth since we have venomous reptiles in the state, so rattlesnakes and one venomous lizard, the Gila monster. And we're going to cover in some depth threats from non-native species. So we have several invasive species issues specific to reptiles and amphibians in the state of Utah. We really want to make sure that people who acquire this permit and take this education course are increasing the awareness of that issue statewide. And also, as part of that, not releasing reptiles and amphibians that have been in captivity is really important. It's still illegal. Under our current rule, it's going to remain illegal. Even if it's a native snake or reptile of any kind and you have it in captivity, it can develop diseases in captivity that when you re-release it, those diseases can establish in wild populations and be very problematic for management and conservation. Covering some degree habitat conservation and the regulatory structure. And then after they pass the education course, the permit can be purchased. And all of this will be online. We'll all have this on our webpage to access. So in addition to this permit, we've established limits for native reptiles and amphibians. And we used three categories from our existing regulatory structure. So increasing from most conservative bag limit to most liberal bag limit. Those are the limited, standard, and expanded bag limit categories. In the limited category, that would allow for 2 yearly and 4 in total possession, and that will apply to 14 species of reptiles. And we worked with the user group to put reptiles into this category that are most valued by the group, but also that we want that information for about where these things are in the landscape and who's really interested in them. Standard category are for things that are not as valued or not as popular with the herping community, but some people still do like to go capture these things and bring them home. So we have a slightly more liberal bag limit there. That would be 3 per year and 9 in total possession. That will apply to 10 species of amphibians and 25 species of reptiles. Expanded category is our most liberal category. So this is for four species of lizards that are very, very common in Utah. There's several species of snakes that people keep that only reliably eat lizards in captivity. So this allows people to collect food for their pet snakes. This is probably the most important change that we're proposing. And as far as I'm concerned, this is incredibly valuable to have this harvest reporting structure for reptiles and amphibians. And we will be the only state to have this as far as I know. So we'll have an online reporting structure where the species, the number taken, the locality of the capture are all going to be reported within 72 hours of the take of that animal from the wild. And that timestamp is particularly important. That lets us know the when and where that both the animal was active and that people were looking for it. So timestamping when these animals are active is incredibly important for knowing when they're active and where they're found, times of year, climate-related activities. All of that ties into how we manage and conserve these species. And so people actively reporting this data is incredibly valuable for the management of this often overlooked species group. And additionally, we'll review all of that reporting data every 3 years, and we'll publish it in a guidebook. We'll have a bag limit category, if you will, of non-controlled species. So species in this category can be collected in any number, but they cannot be released back into the wild, and no permit is required for anything that's in the non-controlled category. So this applies entirely to invasive reptiles and amphibians in the state of Utah, so bullfrogs and aquatic turtles, so like red-eared sliders and snapping turtles. And we strongly encourage people to kill all of these animals upon harvest. They're not native to the state of Utah. They currently are vectors for diseases that are problematic for our native species. So, please do not, at the very least, do not ever re-release one of these organisms back into the wild. And finally, we'll have a category of prohibited species. So species classified as prohibited can only be possessed with a variance from the Wildlife Board. So non-native venomous reptiles. If it's some exotic snake that you've seen in a movie or heard of that doesn't occur in North America, that's prohibited. So cobras and things like that. Will require a variance from the Wildlife Board. Again, if it's a native venomous snake, so it's a rattlesnake and it's native to the state, they can apply for a certificate of registration, and that'll come through the Salt Lake office, and we'll review it there. Crocodiles, alligators, caimans, if it looks like a crocodile or an alligator, that's prohibited. We'll have several species of prohibited amphibians, so relic leopard frog, Arizona toad, Columbia spotted frog, and boreal toad. We have current conservation concerns for these species or threatened and endangered concerns and conservation agreements for these species, so they're going to remain prohibited. Two native reptiles to the state, the Gila monster and the Mojave Desert tortoise, have threatened and endangered issues or conservation agreements, and so they're going to remain prohibited. And again, any species that we develop conservation concerns, either via this reporting or just our own regional biology data, can be moved to the prohibited category or be prohibited by area closure. So if there's certain areas of the state where we think the harvest is getting particularly intense or we have habitat concerns, we can close those areas. The category of propagation, so individuals who want to catch a pair of snakes, a male and a female, and that are native to the state of Utah and breed those, they will be allowed to do that, and they will be allowed to sell the offspring from that breeding event, so long as the sale of those offspring does not exceed the cost of basic husbandry of those organisms. Then that sale is allowed with the permit that they acquired via the education course. If they're entering into a business model, if they are entering into a profitable business, they're generating a significant portion of their income from this activity, then they're going to need a commercial COR. We developed a packet of this entire regulatory change, which included a briefing paper, the list of all of the species in the bag limit categories, and we sent that off to the Department of Health and the Utah Department of Ag. And both of these organizations expressed support for this regulation as written, and the Department of Health specifically liked the educational course component. So just to summarize and hit some of the high points again, we're going to move to a permit instead of certificates of registration for activities that would just generally be considered herping. So going out and looking for these things and taking things that we have bag limit categories for, that's going to be a permit that you buy, and it's going to require an online education course. We're going to establish bag and possession limits for native reptiles and amphibians and establish a mandatory reporting requirement for reptile and amphibian harvest or take. And I just really want to emphasize that this is a very novel model, and it's really important for us in the native species section to get this information. It helps us really improve the information that we're getting when we make management decisions about these animals. Non-native venomous reptiles will be prohibited, and a variance will be required, and native venomous snakes will require a certificate of registration. With all that being said, I'd just like to thank everyone at the division that helped me work through the process of updating this regulation. Definitely want to thank the user group. They showed up to several meetings at the Salt Lake office. Several people commuted a long way to these meetings, which were held between 6 and 9 at night. So this is a user group that was very engaged with this process and really cares about this revision. All the pictures in this presentation are of people in the user group. So it's admittedly a small group, but an active group of individuals that really care about this revision process. So thank you again.
Thank you, Drew. Any questions by the rec? Questions?
Yeah, I've got a question, yeah. Mr. Chair. Yeah, Drew. What's the common use of like a native venomous snake, say a rattlesnake, or the user groups? What are they using these for?
So we do have commercial CORs for people who have rattlesnakes that use them for dog avoidance training.
Oh. Okay.
And so they do have an actual applied use in some cases. There's just people who really enjoy rattlesnakes and really like to observe them in captivity. And so we have to consider that use.
Okay.
I have a question. So the touching, taking pictures, and then turning them loose. There was an incident a few years ago up Strawberry, and they caught the little endangered toads, I believe they were, and they had to destroy them all because they'd been touched. And so is that just a change in the way things are being viewed, or has it been proven that that's not an issue? Or?
So in that area, you have boreal toad, which is one of the prohibited species. We would strongly prefer people do not touch boreal toad. So you can move the disease that causes decline in boreal toad, which is chytrid fungus, just by touching one toad and another. So it is problematic to catch.
But it will be legal in this case, technically?
Technically, that would be illegal. I would strongly encourage people to avoid touching frogs, especially at high altitude areas, just because of the disease issues that we're having.
Okay.
Other questions?
I actually have a quick question. So what about for classroom use? You still have to have a special permit, or could you go through this process?
So if it's for reptiles, this process is probably fine. It kind of depends on the scale of the activity, so I'd encourage you to communicate with me about the scale of it. If it's for amphibians, technically, if you're going to move them, you also do need alive and then keep them in a classroom. Mm-hmm. If you're going to keep them there for eternity, we can work with you. But if you want to re-release them, you have to get approval from ag, disease approval. So we can test for chytrid in that zone and then again in the classroom and just make sure that they're disease-free.
Yeah, Dan.
Yeah, one more question, Drew. So the smooth green snake, I thought that was kind of a species of conservation need within Utah.
Sure.
Kind of a rare species, but I see it on the list.
Yeah, I think this is a great opportunity to send herpers out. It's a species that has not been observed very often in Utah, but because it hasn't been observed often is why we have a concern about it. It's not that it's necessarily rare. It's not a conservation concern in any other state that it occurs in. So it's just that nobody's probably really aggressively looked. Mm-hmm. And these herpers have felt before that the rules were too prohibitive for them to go look and then report that information back to us. So this is giving us that tool to send those people out in the landscape comfortably and confidently.
I see. Thanks.
Any other questions? Comments? That looks really, really quite interesting.
It is.
Okay, well, we'll call vote for a motion. We want to make a motion on this one, Dan?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we accept this action item on the HERP. I don't know what you call it, but as it was presented by Drew here tonight. Yeah.
We have a motion?
I will second that motion.
Brett Prevedum had a second. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, unanimous. Well, thank you. That was our last action item, so internal business we need to take care of so none of the RAC members can leave, but we'll, for right now. But I think this meeting is officially over, though, now, right?
Yeah.
All right. We'll close this meeting as of right now at 7:30. We did it in actually less than an hour because we had a late start. Wow. Thanks, everybody.